Support for this public radio podcast comes from Mellon Financial Corporation, helping financially successful individuals and families protect and maximize their assets through the practice of wealth management. Mellon.com. And by A.G. Edwards, caring for nest eggs for more than 120 years with a commitment to provide objective financial advice. Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, dedicated to a prudent approach to investing. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
Move along, folks. Nothing to see here. Pay no attention to that unemployment report that came out this morning. It's only 4,000 jobs that were lost last month. Still, does kind of make things look like an economic car wreck, doesn't it? From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Reuters, the world's news and information source, working to make a difference every day. Before it's news, it's Reuters. And by Bank of America, believing that healthy communities and a healthy planet are essential to creating opportunities for everyone. Bank of America, Bank of Opportunity.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Great to have you here on this Friday. It's the 7th of September today. And in the grand scheme of things, 4,000 jobs aren't really that many. But when the Labor Department reported this morning that for the first time in 4 years, the employment market lost ground, well, you'd have thought the apocalypse was upon us. Wall Street threw in the towel, Congress got itself involved. And the people who were supposed to know these sorts of things, the ones who had been expecting a gain of more than 100,000 jobs, they spent the day trying to explain. Our senior business correspondent Bob Moon has more.
Many of those shocked analysts were saying today that about the only thing that would shock them more than today's numbers is if this report doesn't finally wipe the poker faces off the nation's central bankers. It's not so much that it forces their hand. At Mission Residential Research, Richard Moody says it actually gives Fed Chairman Ben Bernanke some cover to cut interest rates without the appearance he's just bailing out Wall Street.
With this employment report and also with the downward revisions to the June and July reports, I think the economic data is soft enough. They have the latitude to cut the Fed funds rate for economic reasons as opposed to what's going on in the financial markets.
Some experts are now concerned that job losses could make a bad situation worse. Joshua Shapiro is chief U.S. economist at MFR.
It puts the future of consumer spending at risk because income from job growth was basically propping the consumer up. And if that is weakening quite substantially, then the consumer is in trouble. So it sends some serious alarm bells about the underlying health of the economy.
Word of the job losses even prompted a prominent congressman to break with the tradition of not putting political pressure on Federal Reserve policymaking. House Financial Services Committee Chairman Barney Frank said flatly he wants an interest rate cut when Chairman Bernanke and his team meet on September 18th.
The time has come to take action that will make a more serious slowdown less likely.
While the pressure is clearly mounting, still other data due next week. Readings on consumer credit and business inventories could also sway the Fed policymakers. And economist Ken Maitland says they'll undoubtedly be looking at similar situations in the past. Maitland points out that even after the stock market crash of 1987 and the credit crunch of 1998, the economy remained resilient.
You think the whole world was coming unglued, and yet there was no recession.
Maitland is confident that could yet be the outcome this time around. In Los Angeles, I'm Bob Moon for Marketplace.
Picking up on that last bit Bob mentioned about 87 and 98, former Fed Chairman Alan Greenspan said today what's happening in the economy now reminds him a lot of what was going on back then. In this celebrity-obsessed culture of ours, maybe this next item was inevitable. Mattel issued its third major product recall this week, as you know. It was the first, though, pulling Barbie doll accessories off store shelves. And so we learned today, Congress is getting involved. Lawmakers will hold hearings later this month into why so many tainted Chinese imports have been showing up. Mattel CEO Bob Eckert will be on the hot seat, of course, but the feds could also feel some pain, specifically the government agency responsible for consumer safety. From North Carolina Public Radio, Marketplace's Janet Babin reports.
The hearing's expected to delve into Mattel's system for reporting hazardous toys to the Consumer Product Safety Commission. There are questions about exactly when Mattel knew about its lead paint problem. Mattel did not respond to a request for an interview. And lawmakers are wondering why so many toys contain lead. Most of this summer's recall centered on lead paint. It's banned in the U.S., but is legal elsewhere. paint consultant Rick Granito says lead paint does have certain advantages.
People like leaded pigments because they have very good hiding power, good coverage. And as opposed to the organic pigments, there's a big economic advantage.
But cheaper isn't always better for a company's bottom line. Crisis manager Jonathan Bernstein says Mattel could have done a better job with the recall that he says took too long.
They're missing the compassion component of this, which is unfortunately a very common corporate mistake. I'm kind of surprised that a corporation their size doesn't have better advice than they appear to be receiving.
But Bernstein says the Consumer Product Safety Commission is notoriously slow on recalls, too. Consumer groups complain that the commission's been understaffed for years and doesn't get enough federal money to properly do its job. Rachel Weintraub's with the Consumer Federation of America.
Our ultimate goal would be to restore the commission's budgetary authority to what it was when it was created in the 1970s.
That would be around $140 million. But the agency's allocation this year was less than half that. I'm Janet Babin for Marketplace.
As it happens, President Bush raised the topic of product safety with Chinese President Hu Jintao today. The two met at the start of the Asia-Pacific Economic Cooperation Summit in Sydney, Australia. Lots of things to talk about, of course. One of the big ones is climate change. Australia has put it at the top of the summit agenda. And the president said today the U.S. won't be able to stop global warming without help from developing countries.
In order for there to be effective climate change policy, India and China need to be a part of the process. In order to get them in the process, they have to be included in setting international goals.
Vijay Vaitiswaran is a correspondent with The Economist magazine.
I wouldn't break out the champagne saying that we have the solution to climate change.
He points out there's less that's likely to actually come out of this summit than meets the eye.
A non-binding agreement amongst countries for intensity targets could be seen as being as good as an oral contract. It's only as good as the paper it's written on.
In the lead-up to the APEC summit this weekend, President Bush has had to fend off accusations he's been ignoring the Asian-Pacific region. China, on the other hand, has been very attentive, as our Shanghai correspondent Scott Tong reports.
Most APEC leaders are in Sydney for the weekend, but good friends like to spend quality time together. Chinese President Hu Jintao has spent the whole week in Australia. And he's been busy, agreeing to buy $37 billion of natural gas from down under. China is Australia's top trade partner. David Zweig is with the Hong Kong University of Science and Technology. He says Beijing has traded with the Aussies for years, a big portion being minerals for raw materials.
Many Americans only think about toys and textiles, but China has become a major manufacturer of machines. And you need aluminum, you need copper wiring, you need all kinds of resources that they didn't need before.
China is increasingly an economic giant in Asia, but most Aussies seem pretty laid back about that. Malcolm Cook is with the Lowy Institute, a Sydney think tank. Its new poll found Australians feel just as warmly about China as they do about their longtime ally, the United States.
20 years ago, China had a very negative public image in Australia, largely seen as an ideological threat. So the Australian opinions of China have been growing warmer quite quickly.
It doesn't hurt that Chinese trade has helped Australia's economy grow for 17 years straight. Politicians there don't have to fret about a massive China trade deficit the way folks in Washington do. Beyond Australia, Beijing is trying to cast itself as a benign economic partner across Asia, and Hu Jintao will be making that case throughout the APEC summit. In Shanghai, I'm Scott Tong for Marketplace.
Investors took one look at that jobs report this morning and headed straight for the hills. We'll have the details and the whole week on Wall Street when we do the numbers. When the president returns to Washington next week, he'll have plenty to do. Congress is back in session, as you know, and lawmakers will be voting on everything from budget bills to more funding for the troops in Iraq and Afghanistan. Odds are the president will veto spending bills he thinks are too big, as well as anything that hints of a tax increase. But to succeed in that, says commentator Jeff Birnbaum, he'll need a little help from his friends.
The hostile outlook this fall explains a lot about what's been happening in Washington. Every time you turn around, another Bush loyalist is resigning. First, there was Karl Rove, his chief political advisor, and then there was Alberto Gonzalez, his embattled attorney general. What both men have in common is that they have been considered political liabilities because of controversy surrounding them. Democrats love to vilify them, of course, but Bush's fellow Republicans also expressed their own doubts, privately and publicly. Members of the president's party were getting tired of all the bad publicity surrounding these two Bush lieutenants and were feeling less and less eager to defend them, especially as the president's job approval ratings fell. By allowing potential liabilities to fade into the sunset, Bush was making a strategic choice. He was trading political concessions for fiscal cooperation. More than any time in his presidency, he will need as many Republican backers as he can find on Capitol Hill. He'll need them to beat the Democrats on Iraq, of course, but he'll need them even more to sustain his many vetoes over spending and tax policy. By cracking down on fiscal excess, Bush hopes to find new purpose and a guiding principle to jumpstart his fading presidency. In part, the president is asking Republicans to do what they have always said they wanted to do, keep government small. But that's not always easy when Election Day is just over the horizon. Federal dollars buy a lot of votes. So Bush has clearly decided to shore up Republican support and make Republican friends by dumping their top political headaches. That decision hurt Bush personally, no doubt, but it could also salvage his presidency and reduce the federal budget deficit in the bargain.
Jeff Birnbaum is a columnist for The Washington Post. You can post your comments on our website. It's marketplace.org. Time to check the week on Wall Street with our stockbroker and business analyst guy, David Johnson. We usually go to Dallas for that, but I'll tell you, I don't know where you are this week, David.
I'm in Zermatt, Switzerland, and it's wonderful because, you know, the market started tanking, but it didn't start tanking until around, 2:30 in the afternoon here, so you had half the day to enjoy it.
Yeah, and you picked a good week to be out of town overall.
Well, and I thought it was going to be a quiet week. I mean, typically the period right around Labor Day is a very quiet week, and people sort of drift on back into the marketplace. But this one was a little different. Of course, everything was pointing toward today and the employment numbers, and the employment numbers were weak. So, you know, our fate was sealed early on.
Yeah, you're being kind when you say weak, right?
Yeah, well, 250 points, something like that. But let me tell you that, you know, you look at this market today, if, you know, the end of the world was coming and we were slipping into a recession and the Fed was way behind the curve and it really misjudged this thing, then we'd trade 2.5-3 billion shares today. We didn't even make 1.5 billion shares.
Well, let me ask you something, though. I mean, usually when you have a day like this after a number like the one we had today, what happens is there's a little fall and then people sort of regain their footing because they say, well, now surely the Fed's going to cut rates.
Well, surely the Fed's going to cut rates and probably aggressively, and they may well be behind the curve. But, you know, there's a lot of stuff out there that's making a lot of money. I've been driving around Europe for the last 10 days, 2 weeks or so. This place is just humming. Every place I go, there are, in Italy even, I mean, they're big cranes, they're building stuff, so the global economy is doing great. Now, go back to what you and I have talked to about many, many times. As you look at the global component, the global aspect, the earnings that come from the global part of, you know, Dow stocks or S&P 500 stocks, and it's enormous.
How much of that is, you know, not the world doing well, but us playing catch up with the dollar?
You know, that's a good question. And in fact, you know, and I'm telling you a little parochially, the first thing that I thought about this morning is my vacation just got a lot more expensive because the dollar just got a lot worse. Clearly, I think that's part of it. But, you know, that's why you diversify your investments. You don't invest all in one place.
Before I let you go, David, let me put you on the spot, get back to something you said a minute and a half ago. You said the Fed's going to cut rates aggressively, perhaps. What does that mean, 0.5%?
Oh, I don't know. You know, I think that would scare the daylights out of everybody. Maybe 0.25% right away with a real clue that they're going to cut another quarter. And then, you know, when we're talking a couple of months from now, they may be 1% lower than they are. I think they missed it. I really do. I think they're behind the curve.
All right. Well, we'll try to catch up next week. You're home. Is that right?
Absolutely.
All righty. David Johnson from Zermatt. Thank you, David.
Good to be with you, Kai.
Coming up, it roars, it revs. It's a four-wheeled American monster.
And that's what the fans come to see. They want to see this truck. I mean, it's 110% kick-ass. That's all it is to it.
But first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Industrials plunged 249 points today, about 1.9%, closing at 13,113. That's a lot of 13s if you want to read into that. The NASDAQ sank 48 points, about 1.9% there, to end at 2565. The S&P 500 fell 25 points, 1.7%, to 1453 at the bell. For the week, all the major indices were down. The Dow lost 1.8%. The NASDAQ down 1.2%. The S&P 500 1.4% to the offside. Downshifting sales sent Harley-Davidson skidding 9.25% today. General Motors, the biggest U.S. car maker, fell nearly 5%. Heavy equipment maker Caterpillar lost more than 3%. And you're listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments. Today, Putnam manages money for more than 9 million individual and institutional investors worldwide. Putnam Investments, a prudent approach to investing. And by Siemens. From grade school to grad school, Siemens supports America's next generation of innovators with Student Science Days, plus scholarships and awards for students, schools, and teachers. Science and technology reports are supported by Boston Scientific, committed to delivering what's next in medical technology to help clinicians improve and extend lives. BostonScientific.com. Marketplace is podcasting. Marketplace Takeout is a mix of our best stories from the past week, the cream of the crop from our reporters around the world, delivered to you on the go wherever you are. Want to sign up? Just go to marketplace.org and click on the podcast link at the top of the page. Or you can download entire shows of Marketplace and Marketplace Money at audible.com.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a glance at what's coming up Monday. In Washington, the Federal Reserve reports on consumer credit for the month of July. On the eve of 9/11, Homeland Security Secretary Michael Chertoff joins the Senate Homeland Security and Governmental Affairs Committee to discuss the terrorist threat to the U.S. 6 years later. And it's a time to take on a new point of view in the workplace during National Boss Employee Exchange Day. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from American Public Media. I'm Kai Rizdal. Let's say, just for argument's sake, you buy yourself a car company. And let's say, again, you know, just for argument's sake, it's called Chrysler. You'd need some people to help you run it, right? That's exactly where Cerberus, the private equity group that actually did buy Chrysler, finds itself. In the past couple of weeks, they've hired some big-name automotive talent, including a guy named Jim Press, who until earlier this week ran North American operations for Toyota. That's a company that you might have noticed is doing pretty well selling cars. We've called our own automotive talent to talk about it, the New York Times Detroit Bureau Chief Micheline Maynard. Hiya, Mickey.
Hi, Kai. How are you?
I'm all right, thanks. You know, all the talk since Cerberus bought Chrysler has been they're going to flip it, right? They're a private equity group. They're going to buy it, strip it down, and flip it. What do these hires tell you about whether or not that's going to happen?
Well, honestly, I was in the strip and flip camp myself. I was pretty sure that they were in here to make money and get out of the business in 3 years or so. But you don't hire someone like Jim Press, who is one of the most respected auto executives in the business, if you're going to strip and flip a company. I mean, this is someone who comes from Toyota, which one of its founding principles is that you respect employees and you grow. So I think that's a great reassurance that Cerberus isn't coming to Detroit to take Chrysler apart.
One of the other people they hired, though, was the marketing person from Lexus. Don't they sort of need to work on product before they work on marketing?
Well, I think one of the reasons that Deborah Wallmeyer was hired is that she has worked closely with Jim Press, and that's his specialty. And I think what they're going to do is look at the Chrysler brands, Chrysler, Dodge, and Jeep, and see what they can do about their identities. I mean, Dodge is known for being one of the most masculine brands in the business. Jeep had a great identity 10 years ago, but everybody's got an SUV now. So how do you differentiate Jeep? And then with Chrysler, you know, they've tried a number of times to make it into more of a luxurious brand, and that hasn't worked. And so I think they're going to try to start over with some of these brands.
What is Ron Gettelfinger, the head of the United Auto Workers, saying about this? There are negotiations going on, of course, about new contracts.
Well, my colleague Nick Bunkley was at a luncheon with Mr. Gettelfinger yesterday, and he said that Mr. Gettelfinger said this is a coup for Chrysler, that this is a great move. And he also said, you know, kind of tongue-in-cheek, that he welcomed Mr. Press to Detroit and to the UAW. You know, that's a jab at Toyota, which has a plant in California where they have UAW members, but none of their other plants do.
So do you think Press is gonna have what it takes negotiating with the UAW?
Well, nobody really knows. One of the big mysteries this year is whether they'll even pick a target company, one company to negotiate with, or whether they're going to come out and just say that they've reached a simultaneous agreement with all of the car makers. And, you know, it's only a week before the contracts expire, and there's just a great veil that's dropped over this whole process.
Nick Bunkley had his lunch. You had yours today with Mr. Nardelli. What was that like?
Well, Mr. Nardelli spoke to a group called the Automotive Press Association here in Detroit, and, you know, it was like a rock star. I've seen Bono myself, you know, I've seen the Pope myself, and Luciano Pavarotti, and this is kind of exactly what that was like. He had a horde of reporters around him, cameras, lights, you know, it was sort of this moving amoeba trying to get out of the room. So he's actually overshadowed Alan Mulally. A year ago, Alan Mulally at Ford was the center of attention, and now it's Bob Nardelli.
Did he say anything of substance?
Yes, he absolutely did. One of the things that he said is that the new Chrysler board is going to meet in October, and they're going to look at what's going on in the economy and come up with a three-year plan for dealing with some of the softness in the economy. You know, having been at Home Depot, he's very aware of the housing market, and he said there's a direct link between what's going on in housing and what's going on in autos. And so I think they're going to look at the economic indicators, they're going to see what they need to do to Chrysler's restructuring, and then they're also going to look at the product plan and make some decisions about that.
Micheline Maynard runs the Detroit Bureau for the New York Times. You can read more about Bob Nardelli online, I'm sure, and in the paper tomorrow morning. Mickey, thanks a lot.
Thanks a lot, Kai. Have a good weekend.
As Chrysler and the rest of the American auto industry struggle to get traction in key foreign markets, there is some good news. We sent reporter Rico Galliano to Sweden not too long ago, land of the safe and dependable Volvo, to check out a growing craze for one not entirely practical U.S. automotive export.
A bright summer morn in the little city of Gothenburg, Sweden. Birdies sing in the trees. Here comes the tram. Cars are discouraged in the sparkling, clean city center. Nearby stands Ullevi Soccer Stadium. It doubles as the largest solar power plant in the country. And inside Ullevi?
Gothenburg, Sweden! Welcome to Monster Jam!
10 giant trucks on 6-foot tires scream around a dirt track. Airbrushed on their side panels are names like Gravedigger and Maximum Destruction. They kick up tornadoes of soil. There's a smell of burning tires, something the people of Gothenburg may have never experienced before. They love it. Back in the 70s, American farmers started competing to determine whose tractor was the most badass. Monster trucks are their offspring. The fiberglass hot rods can and do crush puny regular cars into steel pancakes. They are big, loud, silly, scary, obnoxious, and therefore even more American than apple pie. Yet for the last 4 years, the company Live Nation has been selling out Monster Jams in stadiums all over mild, enlightened Europe.
It exceeded our expectations.
Dave Cordovano is a director of marketing at Live Nation. He says last year Monster Jam sold 3 million tickets worldwide. Europeans bought just 250,000 of those, but growth, like the show, is explosive.
The first year we went over, we had performed in three cities. It's now grown to 12, so in a matter of 4 years, we've tripled the business over there.
Gothenburg's hosting two sold-out shows in one day. Outside Ullevi Stadium, I asked this Swedish teen, what's the appeal?
Big cars. That's all.
Well, that was easy. But bringing the show to Europe wasn't. Beforehand, Live Nation showered Eurocable with Monster Jam TV shows to familiarize audiences with trucks like Monster Mutt, it looks like a dog, and Escalade. It's a really big Escalade.
Director of Operations Roy Jansen says there were logistical issues, too.
You know, here in the U.S., we've got Crown Victorias and Chevy Caprices and big cars. The big problem, though, in Europe is finding big cars to crush.
Another not-so-big thing in Europe? The Swedish Monster Truck Association. Yes, there is one.
My name is Conny Carlson, and I'm the chairman of Monster Truckers in Sweden. We have been monster racing in Sweden for about 20 years.
Do you race?
I race, and I have a new truck. It's called Mean Farmer. It's very brand new.
Why is it called the Mean Farmer?
I am a farmer in my profession.
Carlson's got to keep his day job because he can't make a living as a Swedish monster trucker. The association only has about 200 members. Luckily, one of them happens to be Thor.
From Gothenburg, welcome Anders Blomgård and Thor! The first Swedish truck ever to compete in a monster jam event.
Thor features an airbrushed likeness of the Viking god holding his mighty hammer aloft with lightning bolts shooting out, and to me the only thing that could be more awesome is if it was blasting Led Zeppelin. The freestyle competition begins. Each truck gets a minute and a half to show what they've got. Thor screams onto the track and goes into a crazy spin, whirling in place like a 10,000-pound top.
Around and around. Oh my God, my ears are getting punished right now.
That's when it hits me. This is globalization, enacted in what are kind of like giant SUVs, the universal symbol of modern capitalism.
55 seconds, he does a jump. Oh, a wheelie. I want this guy to kick so much butt.
Then at 37 seconds, Thor's engine dies.
Oh, you gotta feel bad for Thor. There's some guys looking at the engine, not acting like a thunder god right now.
He did a great job on his first Monster Jam freestyle. Let him hear you, Anders Blomgård and Thor!
So, unlike the regular car industry, the U.S. remains dominant in monster trucks. But make no mistake, the emerging monster markets are coming. And next time, it could be America that gets crushed like a Peugeot. In Gothenburg, Sweden, I'm Rico Galliano for Marketplace.
We've got pictures of Thor and some of the other trucks Rico was talking about on our website. It's marketplace.org. Next stop for Monster Jam Europe, by the way, a two-day stint in the Netherlands at the end of the month if you, you know, don't have anything else to do.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, where a diversified mix of international investments can strengthen your portfolio. Putnam Investments, a prudent approach to investing. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication.
This final note to bring things back up to where we started today, fallout from the unemployment report and the wider impact of the subprime debacle. Countrywide Financial announced this afternoon it's going to lay off as many as 12,000 people over the next 3 months. That works out to something like 20% of the workforce for the company that makes one of every five home loans in this country. In a letter to employees, CEO Angelo Mozzillo called the crisis in real estate the worst in the history of the industry. He also said he thinks the number of new mortgages will fall 25% by this time next year. And that is Marketplace from American Public Media. Today, the Dow fell 249 points, around 1.9% after that jobs report. The Nasdaq down 48 points, 1.8%. The S&P 500 dropped 25 points. That is 1.7%. Our theme music was composed by B.J. Lederman. Marketplace is produced by Celeste Wesson. The executive producer of the program is J.J. Yore. Coming up on Monday, another conversation from the corner office. This time, Kevin Scherer, CEO of Amgen, the country's biggest biotech company. I'm Kai Rizdahl. Hope you can join us for that on Monday.
American Public Media.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.